Joe Biden assures America that we are not in recession. Supreme Court Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson chooses not to recuse herself from a key case. Abortion advocates try to confuse the public about new laws criminalizing ectopic pregnancies and miscarriages. And just who the heck is running the Editors podcast this week? We will discuss all that and more on this edition of The Editors. I am not Rich Lowry. I am not Charlie Cook. Both Rich and Charlie are out on vacation, and they've left the keys to the podcasting studio with me, Jim Garrity, and that means we're going to party like it's a weekend at Bernie's. I am joined by Alexandra Zan the Squirrel Slayer DeSanctis and Dan McLaughlin, who is not an anthropomorphic baseball, despite what his Twitter account would have you believe. Now, this is the time of the podcast where Rich usually reminds you that if for some reason you're not already following the Editors podcast on a streaming service, you can find us everywhere from Spotify to iTunes, and that we welcome your five-star reviews. And if you want to give us less than five stars, I don't know, is it really worth the effort? Do you really want to log in and have to press all those buttons? I say don't bother. It's too much effort, and you have better things to do with your life. But if you do want to give us five stars, go ahead, because I know it. I just know it in my gut. The world is yearning to hear from you. Our sponsors for this episode are NetChoice, Quip Toothbrushes, and the new Brad Thor thriller novel, Rising Tiger. But first, we're going to hear from our friends at NetChoice, who want you to know new polling shows 65% of Americans blame Joe Biden and the Democrats for rising inflation. If they stand on a unified platform to fight inflation, Republicans will likely do well in this year's midterm elections. But some lawmakers, like Representative Buck, are degrading that strategy by backing proposals which 85% of Americans believe will make inflation worse. The last thing Republicans should be doing ahead of the midterms is supporting progressive pet projects. Only 1% of voters say they want Congress to focus on tech regulation, while 60% say they want lawmakers to focus on inflation. To win in November, Republicans should listen to the people and fight back against inflationary regulations pushed by progressives. Join us in urging lawmakers to oppose Democrat pet projects like S-2992 and tell Congress to focus on the issues that matter to you. Learn more about this fight to send a letter to your representatives at netchoice.org/2992. This message was brought to you by NetChoice. And with that out of the way, Dan, Zan, which is a very convenient naming for this episode. This past weekend, Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen and other Biden administration officials were on the Sunday shows, insisting that while we might learn Thursday morning that the U.S. has had two consecutive quarters of declining gross domestic product, which is the traditional definition of a recession, Yellen was insisting we're absolutely positively not in a real recession. And then on Monday, Biden doubled down, insisting we're not going to be in a recession, in my view. So, Zan, this is usually where Rich would ask his all-purpose, open-ended question of, what do you make of it? Now, whenever I hear that, I always think of the movie Airplane, and I want to say, well, Rich, I can make a hat or a brooch or a pterodactyl. But instead, I will ask you, Zan, when you think about the, what do you think of the administration's sudden interest in redefining what a recession is?
That's very specific. I appreciate the specificity of the question. What do I make of it is, I've never seen Airplane, so I've never had that reaction, but I always wonder, I'm not sure, I haven't made much of it yet, but we'll see where I go. I think that the impulse to redefine terms is a very common one. As someone who covers abortion, we see this all the time, right? If we don't like what the word pregnancy means, we'll just call it something else. We'll redefine what pregnancy means so that we can get what we want from the abortion debate. They do it with every political issue, so I'm not surprised to see it this time around. I think the impulse here is very clear, right? They don't want to have the headlines saying that we're in a recession. They don't want the average person who knows things are bad, but maybe just kind of pays attention at a top level, doesn't dig down into all the details the way the three of us might. They don't want to have that buzzword going around. And so they're just going to try and define it away so that they don't have that label slapped on what's happening. And I guess I get the impulse, right? But I don't think it's actually going to work, A, because you can't really redefine that successfully. There are a lot of people who know more than them who are not going to let them get away with it. And loud voices who are not going to let them get away with it. But on top of that, most people, I don't think, actually care, right? The impulse of, if we don't call it a recession, people won't be as upset. I don't think that's true, right? Like, I went to the grocery store last week and the whole grain bread I usually buy is now $7 instead of used to be $5, I think, okay? Costco coffee beans were $10. Kirkland brand were $10 last month. They're now $16, right? People are going to notice things like that. And they don't care if Joe Biden is going to admit that it's a recession or not. They know that their bottom line is hurting.
Dan, I find it easier to defend this strategy of it's not a recession, trust us. If I thought it was going to work, I just don't really have a hard, I have a hard time seeing how it works. And what Zan just kind of laid out there, I feel like everybody, your casual conversation with your neighbors, everybody's got some, oh my God, can you believe these prices these days type stories. Dan, is there any way this works? Or does this seem like, you know, Biden and the team lamely trying to do a Jedi mind trick and kind of, you know, hypnotize people into thinking, oh, you know, it looks like a recession and it smells like a recession, but it's not really a recession.
Well, Jim, and I assume I'm not contractually obligated to refer to you as the Sage of Authenticity Woods. you know, I think that what they are doing, I mean, at this point, they're going to end up with, well, it's not a recession, it's a woman. You know, what they're doing, though, I mean, I think Zan is right on the nose here, though, that what they're really doing is working the refs, right? They're not trying to convince the average voter that we're not in a recession. They're trying to convince the press not to call it a recession. And so within those parameters, you know, this game does kind of sort of work sometimes because they have a sympathetic press, although certainly not the kind of, I don't think that they really have the kind of sycophantic press that, say, Obama or Bill Clinton had. Biden is just not that, he's not that charismatic a candidate, you know, a character. You know, he's not as progressive as some of them would like, even though he kind of drifts in the wind. So, you know, look, Bill Clinton probably could have pulled this off, right? Just through absolute sheer chutzpah. But I don't think Joe Biden can, and I don't think it's going to help him a whole lot. But I think the press will play along at least for a while with, well, maybe it's not a recession. The other problem with this, though, which you know, the more sort of devious-minded media folks could tell you, is that if you keep going out there saying it's not a recession, it's not a recession, you're still going to end up with a bunch of headlines with the word recession in it. And that's not good either.
Yeah, I was going to say, Zan, you laid out a couple of good examples of you go, you buy something, and it's way more expensive than it used to be, and you just feel it. You know, even if you can afford it, you still are just, your eyes kind of pop at that. And one of the things I keep, you know, expressing frustration with is that if we only saw increased prices on home purchases, or we only saw increased prices on new cars, well, those are the things you buy once a year, or you know, once every couple of years. You know, some people don't move for decades at a time. Some people get, you know, a good 10, 15 years out of their car. Usually it's about, I think about 5, 6, 7 years is the average. But this is something that every single time you go to the grocery store, you feel. So, I kind of am left wondering why the Biden team thinks they can, okay. Is there any way like a politician can fool people into thinking they're actually doing better than they are?
Yeah, I think it's impossible. And I'm speaking as someone who, has a car that I think it's a 2007, we have a 2007 Volvo. So definitely really, on its last legs, it's doing a great job, but the time is going to come for us to have to buy a new car. It's a car my husband had since before he got married that his parents had when he was a kid. So there's one thing we're going to be in the market for, and it's a bad market. We're looking into the possibility of getting a mortgage, buying a house in the next year or two. Bad time to be doing that. So that's another area where we're going to get, you know, just absolutely demolished. Going to the gas pump, by the way, another thing a ton of people do, much more than buying a house or buying a car. Horribly expensive. And we were just talking last night, there's this kind of bridge closed in our neighborhood and a gas station on the other side of the closed bridge where they're doing construction. And on the other side of the bridge where we'd have to drive like a mile and a half around to get to it, gas is $3.95. And just yesterday we said, wow, we got to make a pilgrimage over there to get our $3.95 gas. Yes. And a year ago we would have said, are you kidding me? $3.95, right? But that's cheap here. It's, you know, almost 70 cents cheaper, I think, than the closest gas station to us. And then the grocery store, right? Our grocery bills are now probably double what they were at this time last year, if I'm being fair. So none of this is a good thing for a couple that just got married a year ago, right? We're trying to save. We're trying to, you know, buy a house. We're probably going to have to buy a second car at some point, maybe even a first car. And it's a bad situation. It's a bad scene. And there are a lot of people out there who are a lot, certainly worse off than us. We're very blessed to both have good and stable jobs, you know, enough income to make it work, but it's not pretty. It's not pleasant. And then you have Biden out here saying, well, don't worry. It's not actually a recession. You know, I don't actually care what you call it. You can call it, you know, a purple unicorn if you want to, but it's a bad situation. And I don't appreciate that the people in charge are trying to weasel out of it by changing the definitions of words so that they don't get blamed for what's happening.
I've gotten those text pictures when someone finds a gas station that's less than $4 a gallon and they're excited. It's like they found buried treasure or something. Dan, I'll give the exit question to you. One, are we in a recession? And two, if we are, how bad is it going to be?
I don't know how bad it's going to be economically. I do think it will be unpleasant and quite bad politically. Look, when you hit the grocery store too, one of the things you find is not only are you paying more, but you're getting smaller portions of everything. The Biden folks are all happy that unemployment is down. A lot of people are working, but when people can buy less and less with what they work for, that's like saying, well, we created more jobs by legalizing child labor. Everybody's working, but you're living hand to mouth. So I'm not an economic prognosticator, but the trend lines all look kind of ugly, and at the worst possible time politically for this president. And happy talk didn't work for George H.W. Bush, and I am not a crook didn't work for Nixon, and I am not in a recession, it's not going to work that well for Biden.
Dan, how are we in a recession? And if so, how bad is it going to be?
Well, I think technically speaking, yes, we are. It doesn't really matter what the people in charge are trying to call it. My limited understanding of economics is that, yes, technically, this does meet the definition or the criteria for it. I'm not sure exactly how bad it's going to be. I mean, things feel pretty bad. I imagine it'll get a little bit worse, but I hope it'll start getting better. At least, like I mentioned, we're looking at houses and things seem to be getting a little bit better for buyers. So maybe that's a sign that things are going to level out a tiny bit. I'm not sure though.
I think you're both correct. I think this is actually, by historical standards, probably going to be a mild one. And yes, the Biden administration can point to low unemployment. But as Dan alluded to, that doesn't necessarily help you when your purchasing power is declining precipitously, which is what we're in for a while. The Fed keeps raising interest rates. That's going to drive down the markets. That's going to have less money flowing around in there. And that will exacerbate the recessionary effects. Recessions are terrible, almost as bad as tooth decay. Good health starts with good habits, and Quip makes it easy by delivering all of the oral care essentials you need for your mouth. Now, even if you're on top of your brushing, you can upgrade your Quip with a new smart motor, which will track and improve your brushing with a free Quip app. And you can earn amazing rewards like free refills, products, Target gift cards, and more. If you go to getquip.com/editors right now, you'll get your first refill for free. That's your first refill free at getquip.com/editors. GETQUIP.com/editors. This is from Quip, the Good Habits Company. We turn our attention to the Supreme Court, one of the specialties of Dan, and there are big cases involving affirmative action coming up before the court in the next term. One involves Harvard, which is a private university you may have heard of, and the other is from the University of North Carolina, which is a public institution. A little while back, the two cases were consolidated, meaning they were to be argued and decided together. During her confirmation hearing, Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson said she would not take part in the consideration of the affirmative action issue because she was on a board that advised Harvard on policy matters. Participating in the case would represent a potential conflict of interest, she said. But now, all of a sudden, wait a second, they might actually separate them, allowing her to decide on the University of North Carolina case, but not the Harvard case. I understand, Dan McLaughlin, that if you were indeed a giant baseball, you would be splitting your stitching with anger right now. So why should Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson have recused herself?
Yeah, this is, and I was warning of this time and sadly was not listened to. To back up a little bit, there's two misconceptions about recusals. You hear a lot about recusal. On the one hand, there's a misconception that there's no rules for the Supreme Court. Now, the Supreme Court's it kind of decides for itself. So in that sense, the rules are only self-policed, and the justices are not subject to the full range of the ethical codes that bind lower courts. But there is a federal statute that says when the justices are supposed to recuse themselves. And there have been decisions in the past, decisions by the full court about lower court judges' recusal obligations, decisions by individual justices where they wrote an opinion on why they recused or didn't recuse, as well as a memo that was done in the early 90s by a majority of the justices on sort of the general guidelines. And where the divide is, the other misconception, you know, there are sometimes people who are particularly, you know, the calls that are made for conservative justices to recuse, who seem to think that, you know, any time that a justice, you know, has a friend who has, you know, worked for somebody who filed an amicus brief, or the justice has had some involvement in writing a scholarly article before on the topic or something, that you have to recuse. And that's not the rule. Supreme Court justices have an obligation to sit when they can sit in a case. But they're not supposed to be sitting on cases where they have a financial interest riding on the outcome, where they might be a witness. There's a couple of categories. And you know, I think Justice Jackson fits squarely within those with regard to the Harvard case, clearly, because Harvard is, you know, they're not just somebody commenting on this case. They are the party whose conduct is being challenged. She sat for years all the way up to, I think, only resigning when she was confirmed to the court on the Harvard Board of Overseers, which doesn't directly manage the college's admissions policies, but it does have general oversight of the college. And part of the job description of being on the Board of Overseers is to be familiar with, you know, the major controversies and major issues, you know, in the management of the university. And hardly anything is bigger for a university today than its admissions policies and a long-running legal challenge that goes all the way to the Supreme Court against those. So there's no question that she is entangled with one of the major litigants in this case. And in fact, all the way up to the point at which she was confirmed, from the time the Supreme Court took the case, throughout the briefing, Harvard was essentially acting in, you know, what legally we would recognize to be a joint defense relationship with University of North Carolina. You know, I mean, I think communications, for example, between Harvard and UNC on the case would legally be considered privileged as work product, attorney work product, part of a joint defense. And so it seems to me, when I was looking at this back in February before she was even nominated, that not only is Justice Jackson required to recuse in the Harvard case, but there's a very, very strong argument that she's also required to recuse in the UNC case. But a lot of people, I think, simply assumed, because the two cases were already consolidated for argument, that is, they would be heard together in the same argument, that if she was out of the Harvard case, she was just automatically out of the UNC case, and there was nothing that needed to be done about this. So when then Judge Jackson came before the committee, I was urging the Republican senators, you know, I thought they should have been talking more about the Harvard discriminatory policies generally. For some reason, they seem to think that talking about sex crimes was a sexier subject, which I don't actually agree with. But, you know, that was the political choice made. But, you know, I was insisted at the time that if they were going to ask about Harvard, they needed to not only pin her down on recusal, but specifically ask the follow-up about the UNC case. And only Ted Cruz asked her about Harvard. Now, Ted Cruz is, whatever else you may say about him, a brilliant lawyer. He is the best questioner on the Senate Judiciary Committee. There are, in fact, shockingly few members of Congress who actually understand how to frame a question or even what a question is. I remember during the Alito hearings, then Judge Alito having to confess after listening to Joe Biden talk for 35 minutes that he wasn't sure if there was a question in there, and if so, he had forgotten it. But, you know, Cruz is a very good questioner. He knows how to frame a question, how to get an answer, et cetera. But when he, once he got the answer that he was looking for on Harvard, and she said, you know, look, I am going to recuse myself because of my connections, my involvement with Harvard, he didn't ask the follow-up question about UNC. Nobody, none of the other Republicans on the committee asked it. And so, you know, when it came time to vote on her nomination, the members of the Senate did not have any information about whether or not she was going to sit on the UNC case. They simply had to make some assumptions about that. And as it turns out, I think those assumptions were wrong. They got rolled because the court ordered on Friday that the two cases would be separated. The order on the Harvard case said Justice Jackson took no part in consideration of this order. And the order on the UNC case did not say that, which very clearly signals that she's going to be on the case. And in fact, there was not really even a great reason to order the two cases to be separated, except to allow her to get involved. I mean, they do involve different distinct legal standards, right? Because UNC is a state institution. It's subject to the 14th Amendment, and Harvard is only subject to the Civil Rights Act. But they're going to be probably, the court is probably going to reach fairly similar conclusions. And it's entirely possible that this will benefit Harvard directly. If the court divides 4-4 in the Harvard case and then reaches a decision that is favorable to Harvard in the UNC case, that will benefit Harvard directly by, you know, benefiting its co-defendant. So I really think that this is, I think it's scandalous on the part of both the Senate Judiciary Committee that nobody asked the question and Judge Jackson that she's really kind of playing fast and loose with the recusal rules, which for all of the good things that she said at her hearings is not an auspicious beginning to her tenure on the court. And this is unquestionably the biggest case of her first year on the court.
So Zan, feel free to weigh in on your thoughts on the justice's choice to not recuse herself. But I think kind of Dan alluded to something that I think might kind of be in your wheelhouse, which is that do Supreme Court justice confirmation hearings matter anymore, or are they all now kind of kabuki theater, and is the questioning out now all just a matter of, you know, praying for the cameras and getting your fundraising moment and all that kind of stuff? Is it, in other words, do confirmation hearings matter anymore?
Yeah, I do think they still matter. They've obviously been politicized quite a bit, mainly because of Roe. And so to me, the most interesting question is, will that change, and how will that change now that Roe has been struck down? And I think there's a very real possibility that the new kind of, there will be a new litmus test. And the question is, what will it be? Will it be something, do you believe in substantive due process? Is this real? You know, will you continue applying it in cases like, you know, if Obergefell were to be questioned, or Griswold, or kind of the things that Justice Thomas mentioned in his concurrence in Dobbs overturning Roe? He seems to be the only justice, at least willing to say out loud, that he doesn't think substantive due process is real. So whether that becomes a flashpoint in the future, whether it becomes a flashpoint over the 14th Amendment, you know, there's a lot of pro-lifers who say, you know, the proper originalist interpretation of the 14th Amendment is that actually you can't have pro-abortion laws, right? Unborn children are human beings and therefore legal persons and are due equal protection under the laws. And then on the flip side, you have abortion supporters who think that the 14th Amendment protects abortion, right? Their argument is the Equal Protection Clause protects women and protects the right to abortion because women need abortion to be equal. So maybe that kind of you know, disagreement over those two types of interpretations might become a flashpoint in future hearings. I don't know. But I do think the fact that Roe has been overturned turns the temperature down quite a bit, or ought to, on confirmation hearings. They only became so politicized and so toxic because abortion supporters knew that what they wanted on abortion was entrenched by the court, and it was not going to be put in place by legislatures around the country, right? There's only a handful of states where the status quo favors what abortion supporters want at the moment. And they knew that was coming if Roe was overturned. And so it became just this vicious battle. Look at what happened with Kavanaugh, to try and keep people off the court who they thought didn't believe Roe was a good decision. So I think it should be the temperature should be turned down quite a bit.
Dan, you kind of alluded to this in your exit question. Actually, before I get to the exit question, I have a natural follow-up. We don't know what the dynamics of the justices are behind closed doors. But let's say a justice chooses not to recuse himself or herself from a really big decision, and other justices disagree. Is there any way, you alluded to this as kind of self-policing, can the other justices raise any objection and say, well, actually, because of your, you know, past history with so-and-so, you should be recusing yourself from this case? Or would this entirely be informal and it's entirely up to the justice? And once the justice decides, there's no way to overrule that or rebuke that?
I mean, as a formal matter, in this case, the other justices could have stopped her, right? Because they could have simply a majority of the court could simply have voted that they were not going to split the two cases. And so she actually needed their help to do this. But as a practical matter, I think, you know, particularly when you're talking about a new justice just joining the court, and a lot of the others are still feeling out, you know, how often is she going to side with us? You know, the liberals want to be sure that she's going to be a reliable ally. The conservatives probably, you know, listen to her, you know, talk about originalism and such at her hearing, and thought, yeah, maybe this is somebody we can win over on some cases in the future. Maybe not a lot of them, but and so because of that dynamic, I think a lot of them are probably unwilling to push too hard. I think there has traditionally not been a culture on the court of criticizing other members of the court for not recusing from cases. Of course, if you go back in history, there are some fairly notorious and egregious examples of the justices deciding things they really ethically should not have decided, going all the way back to Marbury versus Madison. I don't think that there was going to be a fight on this. I think they really do ultimately come down on, you know, each justice has to police themselves.
Then I'll head on to the exit question for you, Dan, and then Zan. What is, you know, is this decision going to shape Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson's reputation moving forward on the court?
I think that depends entirely on how the case comes out, right? If you have like a strong 6-3 majority in the UNC case to pare back racial preferences, for example, and that same 6-justice or even 5-justice majority is in the Harvard case, and she is dissenting from that, it won't look great, but it won't really matter. Whereas I think if her vote turns out to in any sense be decisive, you know, then it becomes a thing kind of like Roberts in the Obamacare case, you know, or some of the other cases where one justice's actions really became a big focus because they cast the decisive vote. So I think we have to wait and see, you know, until roughly a year from now to know how this all shakes out.
Zan, any thoughts on a long-term impact on the justice's reputation?
Yeah, I don't think it. I think there'd be a lot more outrage about it if she were in any way decisive or a swing vote or this change mattered for the outcome of the case. It seems unlikely, as Dan puts it, that it will be. And I think that's probably why there wasn't as much outrage even among conservatives about it, just because it's kind of like a shrug. You know, it doesn't optically and in principle, it's not a good look. It's not the right thing to do. I don't think she ought to have recused herself from both. And there's no good reason to separate the cases other than to let her weigh in on one of them. But given that it won't affect anything, I kind of think there won't be much outrage about it.
Yeah. And okay. If I can add just one more thing here too, the other thing that might happen, which is a thing to watch in this case, is I think the facts are especially egregious in the Harvard case. And so, you know, if you're looking to preserve racial preferences, there may be some hope that separating the two will help get some distance for state universities away from Harvard. So we will have to wait and see.
Okay. Well, anyway, Dan, have you read any good books lately?
Well, I have. And I can recommend another one that you ought to be looking at. From New York Times bestselling author Brad Thor comes a riveting new thriller, Rising Tiger. And folks, if you have not read a Brad Thor thriller before, I highly recommend it. They're great. And you can, in fact, pick them up and not necessarily have to have started with the first book to know where you are. So in Rising Tiger, when the Chinese military launches a barbaric attack on India, America's top spy is drawn into the fray. But in the fight for democracy, who's the predator and who's the prey? Best Thriller Books raves that thriller fans of all stripes will devour this book. Read or listen to Rising Tiger today, available now in hardcover, ebook, and as an audiobook read by Armand Schultz.
Well, thank you, Dan. I concur. I think Brad Thor might be the best out there today. And yes, I'd be saying that even if you hadn't blurbed my last thriller. So it seems like every time you turn around, some abortion advocate is contending that one of the state laws recently passed regarding abortion will criminalize women for having miscarriages or ectopic pregnancies. Now, no one in their right mind wants to do that, and state lawmakers say their laws aren't intended to do that. Thankfully, our Zan DeSanctis has reviewed the text of every significant state abortion limitation as it pertains to exceptions for medical emergencies. Zan, if you don't mind, walk us through what spurred you to write this lengthy and detailed piece and what you found.
Sure. So the piece is about 4,500 words in length for any brave souls out there who want to wade into it. But I really wrote it as a reference and to give a little background. I think we did talk about this on the podcast fairly recently in the context of ectopic pregnancy, but it's actually a much bigger debate. And the debate is essentially, do pro-life laws leave room for doctors to treat women in healthcare emergencies? So this could be an ectopic pregnancy where the embryo has implanted outside the uterus, which is dangerous, right? The baby can't develop there. So no matter what happens, the baby's going to die. And then it can compromise the mother's health because, again, there's not room for the baby to develop there. So is there room in pro-life anti-abortion laws to treat women in that circumstance? Will women who have miscarriages be able to get care or treatment, miscarriage management treatment, either during or after they've suffered a miscarriage? And the main contention from abortion supporters since Dobbs overturned Roe v. Wade has not been abortion throughout pregnancy is a good thing, and here's why. It has not been, any kind of defense of or explanation of why they like abortion, why they think abortion is a good thing, why they think women need abortion. The main argument has been pro-life laws make it impossible for women to get healthcare. And they'll come up, every so often there'll be a piece with, one example of some anonymous source saying a doctor at this one hospital wouldn't give a woman care after she had a miscarriage because his attorneys told him that the pro-life law made it a crime or made it too risky. And there's all these kind of spotty stories like this that are not pinned down, not well sourced. There's only been a handful of them. So there's not much evidence that this is actually happening. But even if it is, right, my contention is this is not a fault of the abortion laws. This is the fault of any doctor and any attorney who's claiming that they can't offer healthcare because of anti-abortion laws. So the way to understand it is an abortion procedure is never actually medically necessary. If a woman has an ectopic pregnancy, if she suffered a miscarriage, if she's in some kind of life-threatening situation, an abortion procedure that directly kills her unborn child is not actually helpful to her health, right? She might need some kind of procedure to, if it's a miscarriage, the baby has already died, right? So you don't need an abortion. She has an ectopic pregnancy, then she can get some kind of treatment, right? To remove the child that's not intended to kill the child, it's intended to save her life. The child is going to die anyway because of where it's located. If she has, for example, uterine cancer, she can get treatment for that. That's not aimed at killing the baby. You don't need to directly kill her baby to treat her for cancer. Whatever these situations are, an abortion procedure is not aimed at helping the mother's health or saving her life. It's aimed at killing the baby. And doctors know this, right? Doctors at Catholic hospitals have for decades not been performing abortions and yet have been treating women who are suffering from miscarriages, who have ectopic pregnancies with no problem, because the distinction here is clear. And the only people trying to muddy the waters about it are abortion supporters who are trying to fearmonger and frighten people. And just to put a fine point on that, until last week, Planned Parenthood's website, on its page talking about ectopic pregnancy, explicitly said this is not an abortion. Treatment for an ectopic pregnancy is not an abortion. And then last week, they erased that sentence clarifying this because they want to contribute to the chaos and the confusion because they think it helps the case against anti-abortion laws. And so what I did is I just went through all of the states that have any kind of more significant abortion restriction. I think the least restrictive is Florida's 15-week ban, but most of them are heartbeat bills or total abortion bans. And I put the text of the exception explaining how a mother's life can always be saved if a mother's life is at risk or she's at risk of substantial impairment. These laws provide exceptions for that. Many of them provide exceptions for cases of rape or incest. And most of them also have explicit definitions of abortion that say this does not include removing a dead fetus, right? So in the case of a miscarriage, and many of them also explicitly note this just has nothing to do with ectopic pregnancy. So they're very clear. If anybody wants to actually look at the laws, understand what's actually happening, it's very clear that women in these circumstances can get care and that the other side is just fearmongering.
Dan, what Zan kind of was just discussing about, an effort by pro-choice groups and pro-choice doctors kind of attempting to spur confusion, attempting to muddy the waters, attempting to make people believe that these laws are more restrictive than they actually are. I kind of believe that confusion is more or less the default setting of humanity and that it takes effort to bring someone out of confusion and chaos and not knowing what's going on. So, Dan, my question to you is, how do pro-lifers counter an argument like this that is designed to sow confusion about what the laws actually do?
The first thing I would recommend is to read Zan regularly. But, you know, I think to cut through it, I think you just have to keep hammering the fact that fundamentally, you know, they're talking about a tiny number of cases that, you know, in most states, you know, I mean, in this specific instance with miscarriages and ectopic pregnancies that aren't even covered by, you know, anti-abortion laws. And, you know, in some of the other cases that are at the margins, you know, rape exceptions, for example, you know, some states have exceptions. And in other states, if perhaps there are not exceptions, there can be an argument over exceptions. But the exceptions don't really relate to most cases. And I do think it really says a lot about what abortion advocates think about the strength of their argument, that their immediate responses have been either to talk about, you know, the tiny number of cases that are outside of the, you know, 99% of abortions, or to talk about things other than abortion. Oh, this is going to lead to the end of gay marriage. Oh, this is going to lead to the end of interracial marriage. You know, it's if in fact overruling Roe was the most horrible of the parade of horribles, you wouldn't need it to, you know, be at the back of the parade.
So an exit question to you, Zan, will this effort by pro-choice doctors work? Will people walk around believing that the law has banned them for getting treatment for ectopic pregnancies, treatment for miscarriages, things like that? Or will your good reporting triumph? Kind of a loaded question.
I don't know if my reporting is going to get the job done. I'm hopeful that we will break through, but it is very discouraging to see, you know, most of my Instagram, just to take a kind of unscientific example in the wake of Roe having been overturned, is basically just clueless young women reposting these memes saying that, you know, if you have a miscarriage now in a state with one of these laws, you're subject to criminal penalties. Now, an additional point I didn't even mention is that all of these laws hold women harmless, right? So if a woman has an abortion, she's never the person being punished, you know, let alone if it's an ectopic pregnancy or a miscarriage situation, which aren't illegal, of course. All of these laws hold the abortionist responsible, not the woman. But there's all this fear mongering everywhere. If you look at all these outlets, the major media outlets covering this, basically none of them are getting this right. And, you know, it's not that hard to read the laws, right? It took me a couple of days of work to just actually look at the text of all these laws. The truth is out there. But I think the problem that we face is that the people whose job it is to tell people the truth don't do it. So I'm hopeful that, you know, the only people buying it are those kind of predisposed to the pro-abortion argument already and looking to confirm their bias, but that people in the middle will do their research and find out what's true.
Dan, will Zan's reporting save the country, or are we all doomed to crash into the sun?
Oh, well, you want the long run answer? the sun beckons. But, you know, I think politically, I mean, look, politically, the it would have been better for Republicans, for example, if Dobbs had happened, you know, further out from a midterm election. But I think it's bad for Democrats that there are, in fact, a couple of months for people to chew over this stuff and realize that some of the hysteria is hysteria. But when you move beyond elections to policymaking, you know, an election policymaking is downstream of elections, of course. But, you know, I think the fact that there are going to be some state legislatures that can tweak and tune their laws if they find something to be wrong with them, if they find that people are confused about them, you know, is something that's actually going to help people get some comfort with the idea that this is something the political system can handle. But the other issue is, you know, at the end of the day, somebody needs a bully pulpit on the right, and we haven't yet found who it is that can come forward and get press explaining some of this stuff. You know, I don't think Republican leadership, for example, or really the activist leadership outside of the party has yet sort of settled on somebody who will be able to cut through the noise. And maybe it will take a presidential campaign before we see that.
Okay. Well, now we move on to our lighter items of our episode. This is, I know so many listeners out there are on the edge of their seats waiting with bated breath because they've been wondering, did Alexander De Sanctis visit a town with Berg in its name this week? Or did she call in airstrikes against the local squirrel acorn cartels? Zan, what's going on in your life these days?
That's a great way of framing it. I will say this is not my light item, but my husband did purchase some mini water guns recently, and they may have been used to shoot at squirrels. So that was not the intention of buying them, but it's been fun to try and fend off intruders that way. But I actually did travel. I did not go to a burg, but I went to, I guess it was technically a little bit further out from the Atlanta suburbs, but in the area of Atlanta for a conference, Alliance Defending Freedom conference. And it was a great time. Got to talk about my new book a bit, got to meet some people that I only knew from Twitter, but had never met in person, made some great friends, and just in general had a great break from the onslaught of the news cycle. And it was a good time.
Zen, what's the title of the book?
Oh, thanks, Jim. Yes, it's called Tearing Us Apart, How Abortion Harms Everything and Solves Nothing. And I co-wrote it with Ryan Anderson. So you can buy that wherever books are sold.
Indeed. So remember, listeners, if you outlaw water pistols, only outlaws will have water pistols. Dan, I understand you're reading a book, and it sounds like the least light book for a lighter item in the history of this podcast. What are you reading these days that's not Brad Thor?
Well, I thought it was pretty light, actually, compared to what I'm normally reading these days. It's a book called Our Team by Luke Eplin. I just finished reading it. And it is about the 1947 to 48 Cleveland Indians, who were in 1947 the first integrated team in the American League. They brought in Larry Doby, the first black player in the American League, during the same season as Jackie Robinson. And the following season signed Satchel Paige, who became the first black pitcher in the American League. Of course, Paige, you know, Doby was a young player. Paige was in his 40s and an established legend. And they went on in 1948 to become the first integrated MLB team to win the World Series. Spoiler, perhaps, if you don't know the history, but
you've had enough time to catch up on that World Series, listeners.
Yes. Well, the Indians have not since then caught up any further on it. It is their last World Championship. And the book really follows sort of the stories of four men: of Doby, Paige, Bill Veeck, who was the Indians' owner and a famous showman, and of course their ace pitcher Bob Feller. And the story is really very much intertwined with, you know, the war. Three of the four men served. Paige was too old. And post-war Cleveland. And so it's a fascinating story. There's a lot going on. I know a lot of this history, and I still learn quite a bit about, particularly about Doby and Veeck in their lives. So if you like baseball books, or if you're even interested in sort of baseball as a window to race relations and post-war America, Our Team by Luke Eplin, I highly recommend it.
Excellent. Well, the lightest thing that's happened in my life in the last couple of days, I remember mentioning that I was going off to Chincoteague and Assateague out in Maryland and Virginia a couple of weeks ago. My younger son was in space camp, and they do it over at the facility that's near the NASA facility. NOAA's got a facility. It's a whole little government, all kinds of secret government bases out on the peninsula of Maryland and Virginia. And my son comes back, and not only did he win the robotics competition, but he's showing me this model rocket that he had made, and they assemble it and they put together a very basic fuel, and there's a parachute that's supposed to deploy, but it didn't really deploy. And he tells me that I guess they have some sort of altimeter or something in there, and this one went up 1,000 feet and the parachute did not deploy. But somehow it managed to come down, and it's probably about, a little more than a foot, and it's got these little 2 or 3 inch wings on them. But he shows it to me, and like two of the three wings are off. I'm like, oh, did it come down hard? No, actually, it's fine. Like, what happened? It's like, oh, I knocked it off a shelf, and two of the wings came off. So apparently model rockets can handle crashing down to Earth from a height of 1,000 feet, but they cannot handle being knocked off a shelf 4 feet high. That's what these things are about. Some engineering skills still need to be worked out there. All right, now we're on to editor's picks. Zan, since often we end up stealing your choice, you get to go first.
Awesome. So my pick is a piece from, I think, late last week by John McCormick, looking at the new right to contraception bill that Democrats, I believe, passed through the House. And I think some Republicans did vote for it. And it's, I think, bad enough just on its face, but digging into the law a bit, or the bill a bit, John discerns that there are some pretty significant religious freedom problems with it. And it also, surprise, surprise, protects abortion. So definitely not something we should be wanting to see pass the Senate.
Dan, what piece in National Review in the last couple of days has impressed you?
Well, the most important thing I think you should read is Zan's piece, but since she just spent several minutes explaining its contents. I would add to that Jack Fowler's piece this morning on Republican attorneys general march into battle. If you haven't been following this story, it's an interesting look at yet again how institutions get taken over by the left, even when more than half of their members are in fact elected Republicans. And so there is a big fight going on over the National Association of Attorneys General, and Jack has it covered.
Excellent. Well, all of those are great choices. Late yesterday, our Dominic Pino, who keeps an eye on all kinds of supply chain issues, trade issues, and economic issues, noticed that, in fact, oil tanker orders are at a record low. In fact, orders for new tankers in the first half of this year were the lowest on record, roughly half the previous low, which is really not good. Now, look, this is the sort of thing that you have fewer tankers, which have less way to get oil around the world, tougher time getting it from suppliers to consumers and to refiners and all that stuff. This is not going to go well for us. And you look at this as one of the long-term consequences of a policy of saying, oh, we're going to move away from energy. We're going to move away from fossil fuels. Well, sooner or later, this catches up with you. As Dominique summarizes, with fewer tankers to transport oil, flexibility goes down and prices go up. Everybody should check that out. All right, so we have handled our editor's picks and our lighter items. Now, this is the point in the podcast where Rich would usually tell you that any rebroadcast, retransmission, or account of this game without the express written consent of Major League Baseball is prohibited. But let's face it, do any of us really care what Rob Manfred thinks? I don't think so. If you want to offer someone else an account of this podcast, go ahead. But I tell you, it's probably easier just to tell them to listen and subscribe themselves. This podcast has been produced by the indisputably incomparable Sarah Schutte, who, oh, by the way, not only makes us sound better than we deserve, also edits the Morning Jolt most mornings, which I often send to her in the form of incoherent Sanskrit. Thank you, Zan. Thank you, Dan. Thank you for listening. We will be back next time, or at least most of us will be back next time. We'll see how Rich reacts when he hears what I've done to the place while he was away.